This week, this year, we have the opportunity to consider the parshas of Vayakhel and Pekudei, each one in its own merit. In a normal year, Vayakhel Pekudei is practically one word, like Shalshudas. So it's nice to have the opportunity to give each one its due attention. Vayakhel, of course, or Vayakhel and Pekudei, ostensibly are reiterating the building of the Mishkan, the manufacture of the Brigde Kahuna, that of course is something of an oversimplification. And the Parsha Vayakhel begins with Shabbos, interestingly, before we get to the Mishkan itself, in the beginning of Perek Lamed Hey, Zeh HaDovar, Eile HaDvarim Hashet Tziva Hashem La'Sososam. That's how Moshe introduces at the end of Pasuk Aleph. And the first thing before we get to the Mishkan is two psukim of Shabbos. Sheish yes yomim te'ose melocha, v'yom ha'shvi yelechem kodesh, Shabbos shabbosom lashem. And of course there's much discussion as to why Shabbos is mentioned before the Mishkan. Rashi tells us that, and of course this is the primary message, is that Shabbos comes first. That is to say, as much as the Jewish people are anxious to build the Mishkan as quickly as possible, but nonetheless, even with regards to the Mishkan, for 6 days you shall work, and Shabbos to rest. We should note, as Mefarshim point out, this message is already presented in the Torah. Last week's Parsha, Parsha's Kisisa, the Torah mentions the Mishkan, and then Achas Shabbos HaTishmeru, and Rashi there comments, even though you wish to build the Mishkan, nonetheless, on Shabbos, take a rest. And therefore, this week, the presentation of Shabbos again seems to be something of a repetition. Although, strictly speaking, it's not a repetition because last week in Parshas Kisisa, it's Hashem speaking to Moshe. And this week in Vayakhel, it's Moshe speaking to Bnei Yisrael. But nonetheless, the assumption is that whatever Hashem told Moshe on Har Sinai, Moshe communicated to Bnei Yisrael. There are a number of other things that are mentioned at the beginning of Kisisa that we don't find Moshe being referred to as communicating to Bnei Yisrael. For that's the assumption. And therefore, there is yet what to discuss in terms of Moshe making a point of referring to Shabbos before discussing the Mishkan itself. And a fascinating insight, interpretation of the relationship between Shabbos and the Mishkan and of the essential nature of mentioning Shabbos first as a prelude to that is to be found in the Sefer Be'er Yosef of Yosef Salat. And he explains that there's actually a significant point of commonality between Shabbos and an aspect of the Mishkan. Normally we set them against each other. It's the Mishkan, but not on Shabbos. But actually they have something in common. For as we know, a central part of the enterprise called the Mishkan are the personalities involved. It revolves around a specific family, namely Aaron and his sons. They are the Kohanim. He's the Kohen Gadol, his sons are the Kohanim. And that, of course, is by divine appointment. But it's an appointment that needs to be understood correctly. And in point of fact, it was an appointment that was famously misunderstood at a certain point down the line. As we know, one of the primary contentions of Korach va'adoso against Moshe is, why is Aaron the Kohen? And the subtext was, how did Aaron get to be the Kohen? Well, Moshe's the leader and Aaron's his brother equals Aaron is the Kohen. It's not fair. It's not right. They claimed that that was what was behind the appointment of Aaron and it was wrong. Now, of course, this claim needs to be examined for its credibility. Ostensibly, they seem to be saying that Moshe decided to appoint Aaron, but who says that Hashem agrees? Maybe Aaron is not the one. We know the nature of the kahuna is that if one tries to be the Kohen and Kohen Gadol and they're not the one, they find out rather quickly. And therefore Aaron has been functioning as the Kohen Gadol. I mean, clearly HaKadosh Baruch Hu is behind it, has agreed to it. Says the Be'er Yosef, Korach contends that is not necessarily so. The fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu consents to the appointment of Aaron does not necessarily mean that it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's quote-unquote idea. Rather, it's possible that Moshe insisted, Moshe pushed, Moshe suggested, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu acceded. That's a possibility, and therefore no one is doubting that at the end of the day, Aaron is there by divine consent. But nonetheless, perhaps it was Moshe's motion to have Aaron installed. That is really the depth of the claim of Korach. If he didn't have Moshe in his corner pushing for him, so maybe it would have been one of us. Now, that's still quite a thing to say. After all, where do we ever find such a concept, such a precedent, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will, so to speak, accede or respond and agree to an initiative of a chacham down here? Well, the truth of the matter is, we do find this. It's actually part of Torah. For this is really the institution of Kiddush HaChodesh. The Torah, and it's the first mitzvah in the Torah, or that is to say, presented to the Jewish people, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. And HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, this Chodesh is for you, the Gemara Darshans, Mesura B'yedchem. It's given over to you. As we know, whatever day the Beis Din decide is Rosh Chodesh, that's Rosh Chodesh. It could be the 30th day, it could be the 31st. The Beis Din need to say Mekudesh, Mekudesh, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay. And based on the day that the Beis Din decide is Rosh Chodesh, that determines what day the Moadim will be. That is why we conclude, as we know, the special middle bracha for the Amidah of Yom Tov with the words, Mekadesh Yisrael v'Hazmanim. The bracha of Yom Tov begins with Kedushas Yisrael. As the Gemara explains in the seventh parak of brachas, it's a two-stage process. Hashem is Mekadesh Yisrael, and Yisrael are Mekadesh the Zmanim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu accedes to that whatever day they chose. And therefore, Korach does have a precedent for his claim. Perhaps Korach's appointment was a Rosh Chodesh Dikah appointment. Moshe began, and Hashem agreed. And it's very interesting to note that Chazal detected for us that one of the attributes or characteristics that Korach's men are referred to as possessing, as they are called Kiriyei Moed. Anashim Ibnei Yisrael, Kiriyei Moed, Nesiei Eda, Anshei Shem. What is the meaning of Kiriyei Moed? Callers of times, says the Medrash, Yodim La'aber Es HaChadoshim. They were all in possession of the knowledge of how to calculate Rosh Chodesh. That would seem to be a rather unconnected qualification for the discussion at hand. Says the Be'er Yosef, not at all. It was very much of the essence. Because what they're saying is, we also know how to make Rosh Chodesh. Essentially, the appointment of Aaron was like Rosh Chodesh. You said Mekudesh down here, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, Mekudesh. We can do that as well. That's why it's highlighted as they approach Moshe. Kiriyei Moed. Now, of course, the truth is nothing of the sort. Aaron's appointment was not the initiative of Moshe, as was the claim of Adas Korach, but rather it was a directive straight from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in fact, therefore, it really partakes of a different type of holy day. Namely, of course, that of Shabbos. Whereas the Rosh Chodesh and the Moadim, they are based on the decision of the Beis Din, Mekadesh Yisrael Ba'azmanim. When it comes to Shabbos, of course, the Beis Din cannot determine which day is Shabbos. Shabbos is Shabbos. And when it comes to the middle bracha for the Amidah of Shabbos, we don't say Mekadesh Yisrael v'HaShabbos. We say Mekadesh HaShabbos. Hashem is Mekadesh HaShabbos direct. And therefore, this is a further dimension, really, to what Moshe is communicating as he prefaces the whole discussion of the Mishkan with a reference to Shabbos. As if to say, whatever is about to follow from here is Shabbostic. It's like Shabbos. Kaviyah v'kaima. It comes from on high. It's not at anyone else's instigation or initiative. And therefore, Aaron's appointment, indeed, is more like Shabbos than like Yom Tov, and that's why Moshe introduces the discussion with Shabbos. It's very interesting to note, as a PS to this comment of the Be'er Yosef, that the Gemara tells us in the fifth parak of Bava Basra that Rabba Bar Bar Chana, as he talks of his many travels there in Daf Ayin Gimel and Ayin Dalet and Ayin Hey, he recounts that once he met this Arab tour guide who told him he would show him where Korach's men are buried. That's a good pitch. And Rabba Bar Bar Chana went. So they come to a place, and there's a crevice in the ground, and there's smoke coming up, and he takes the spear, and he puts the garment on the tip of the spear, dips it in water, and lowers it into to that crevice in the ground, and it sizzles, and there's fire down there. So the merchant says to him, put your ear to the ground. So he put his ear to the ground, and that's when he hears the words, Moshe Emes Vesoraso Emes. That's what they're saying. That's Adas Korach. So the Arab says to him, this is something that they say once a month. That's part of their tikkun. And the Rashbam, in his commentary to Bava Basra, explains, once a month, every Rosh Chodesh. So it's very interesting to note that part of the rectification, part of the making amends of Adas Korach, is to say what they say on Rosh Chodesh Dafka, because part of their platform of their machlokas was to abuse the concept of Rosh Chodesh and say that the appointment of Aaron was like Rosh Chodesh. That's not true. Rosh Chodesh is one thing. This is Moshe Emes v'Torah Asa Emes, they say for all generations on Rosh Chodesh itself. So this is a very interesting comment with regards to the opening of the Parsha, Shabbos before Mishkan. Now, as we know, the connection of Shabbos to Mishkan is not only that Mishkan doesn't override Shabbos, but we learn a lot about Shabbos from the Mishkan. Specifically, the 39 melachos, the lamites, avos melachos, are all derived from the manufacture of the Mishkan, and indeed further aspects of melachos on Shabbos. The way melacha needs to be done, the very interesting concept of meleches machsheves, which defines as the hallmark of a melacha on Shabbos, is also derived from the Mishkan. The meleches machsheves is referred to in the Mishkan. And I'd like to take a look at one of these malachas specifically, from a parshanut point of view, that is to say, how it is derived from the Mishkan. And that is the malacha of kosher, of tying knots. As we know, if a knot is tied in any professional way or long-lasting way, so that is the malacha of kosher. It's the one area of Torah where if something is labeled as strictly kosher, it's not a good sign. Now the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos Daf Ayin Dalet Amud Beis, as it does actually with a number of malachas, some of them are obvious, some less so, is looking to find where do we see the malacha of kosher in the Mishkan? Where did they tie knots when they made the Mishkan? Yeah, they did many things. Where does tying knots come into it? And actually, the Gemara records a machlokas in this regard between the famous Abaya and Rava. Not too long goes by in Shas without Abaya and Rava discussing one thing or another. And here, they discuss this question as to where was the malacha of kosher in the manufacture of the Mishkan. And their answers are quite different from each other. Abaya says, where is kosher in the Mishkan? Well, as we know, the yerios, the curtains and the covering, were woven. Sometimes, it could be that one of the threads would snap. If it snaps, the curtain is possible. The response is, to tie the two loose ends back together again. That is the source of the malacha of kosher in the Mishkan, retying any threads that had become snapped. So says Abaye. Rava has a very different understanding. Rava says that the way that they came to have the malacha of kosher in the Mishkan is that they tied knots in order to make nets. Why do they need nets in the Mishkan? Because one of the items of the Mishkan was wool that was colored with tcheles. Tcheles comes from the blood or the whatever of the chilazon, and they had to get a chilazon. Where did they get a chilazon in the Midbar? Largely from where they got everything else in the Midbar, but they had to catch it. So the chilazon was caught with nets. The nets were tied together, and that's your malacha of kosher. Okay. So it's a very interesting, this is historical for us, background. Where does kosher come from? One could say that the opinion of Rava seems to be somewhat easier to understand. That is to say, the making of nets to catch the chilazon is part of what needed to happen in order for the Mishkan to be assembled. Abaya's source of threads that snapped, it doesn't sound like the type of malacha that necessarily had to happen. It almost seems like if a mishap occurred, or if a contingency situation, something went wrong, it needed to be rectified with this malacha. It almost sounds like a bedieved type of malacha, or malacha response to a bedieved situation. And therefore, if we may ask, why would Abaye not be prepared to accept Rava's explanation that the tying of the knot took the form of tying together nets to catch the chilazon? After all, the tcheles was a primary requirement in the Mishkan. The tcheles needs the chilazon. Now, as we have mentioned, the color tcheles specifically comes from this creature, it's a fish or whatever it is, snail maybe, called the chilazon. And indeed, Rashi states this in the very beginning of Parshas Truma when Tcheles is mentioned for the first time as their materials for the Mishkan are originally being listed. Tcheles, Va'argaman, Rashi says Tcheles, it's colored with the blood of the chilazon. And we would never imagine that this is a subject for discussion. But lo and behold, it is. It is not so straightforward at all. If we look in the Rambam, in Hilchos Tzitzis, and of course, Tcheles in principle features very prominently within the mitzvah of Tzitzis, the Rambam says as follows. Tcheles, this is in Perek Beis, Halacha Aleph. Tcheles ha'amura b'Torah b'chol mokum. The Tcheles that is mentioned in the Torah everywhere. Hu hatzemer hatzavua, it is wool specifically that is dyed, kepasuch sheva kachol, with a certain type of blue, v'zoi d'mus harakia, that's the pure sky, that's the light blue. This is not the only understanding of what color tcheles is. For the Rambam, tcheles is light blue. There are other opinions. It could be dark blue, it could be greenish blue, it could be turquoise, it could be more of a purplish blue. There are a number of opinions about that. We are prejudiced, lahavdil, because in modern Hebrew, that type of sky blue is called tchelet. So we would never have imagined, but that's life, nature imitating art, in the sense that we decided to call it tchelet, but that's not a halachic psak. That's a question of finding a word for that type of blue. Now, Rambam goes on to say, "Vatcheles ha'umor b'tzitzis tzorech shiyeh b'tzviyosa tzviya yodua." There's a very specific way to make it. Ketzad how so? Lokhenat semer. You take the wool and you soak it. Va'acharkach mevi'im dam chilazon. Then you take the blood of the chilazon. You put it together, and out comes tcheles. Okay, so far, nothing seems to be amiss. I mean, the Rambam has introduced the color of tcheles, the background of tcheles, and where you get it from and how you make it. The problem is that the Rambam discusses the issue of tcheles elsewhere in the Mishnah Torah. Of course, the Mishnah Torah covers everything. And therefore, in Hilchos Klei HaMikdash, in Perek Ches, Halacha Yud Gimel, where the Rambam comes to discuss Big Day Kahuna, of course, for future generations, we don't have a Mishkan, and therefore we don't have the roof of the Mishkan, those Yerios, we have a Beis HaMikdash, but Tcheles nonetheless exists as part of the Big Day Kahuna. And the Rambam there says, U'tcheles ha'amura b'chol makom, Tcheles, which is mentioned everywhere, hu hatsemer hatsavua ke'etzem ha'shamayim, it's wool that is colored like the pure sky, v'hu pasuch min ha'kochel, again, that light type of blue. Okay. What is noteworthy about these words of the Rambam? The Rambam, when he discusses Tcheles in the context of Big Day Kahuna, has told us what color it is, but hasn't told us how to get it, hasn't told us where it comes from. Where does that blue come from? And this question is raised on the page of the Rambam by the famous Mishnah Lemelech. Why doesn't the Rambam tell us that you have to bring a Tcheles and describe the process? And the Mishnah Lemelech presents a very simple answer. It is possible, and perhaps even likely, that the Rambam, in this later stage of Mishnah Torah, relies on information that he has given us earlier on in the Mishnah Torah, as if to say, in Hilchos Tzitzis, the Rambam has already told us how to make Tcheles. It's enough, therefore, for the Rambam, later on in Hilchos Klei HaMikdash, to rely on us, going back to Hilchos Tzitzis, should we need to discover exactly how the Tcheles is made. So that's a very simple answer, and therefore, in principle, they both need the chilazim, but the Rambam's mentioned it in Hilchos Tzitzis, and there's a lot of other things the Rambam needs to discuss in the Mishnah Torah. He doesn't need to repeat every time exactly how to make tcheles. However, this approach to understanding the Rambam's opinion is not unanimously shared. The Tiferes Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz, in his famous Perus on the Mishnah is in his Hakdomah to Seder Moed, he is of the opinion that when the Rambam mentions the Chilozon as the source for the Tcheles in Hilchos Tzitzis and not with regards to Big Day Kahuna, it's because the opinion of the Rambam is that it is only for Tzitzis that one needs the Chilozon to make the Tcheles. But when it comes to Big Day Kahuna, as long as one has any dye that will yield the same color in a meaningful way, it is acceptable, even if it's not from the chilazim. Now, that's quite a thing to say. But the truth is, says Tiferes Yisrael, this is the simple reading of the words of the Rambam. Because the Rambam in Hilchos Tzitzis, when he described the color of Tcheles, he said, Tcheles ha'amura b'Torah b'chol makom, whenever the word Tcheles is mentioned in the Torah, and where is it mentioned in the Torah? Well, Tzitzis and the Beis HaMikdash, really. It's the color of the sky. Next sentence of the Rambam. V'ha'tcheles ha'amura b'tzitzis. Tcheles, which is mentioned with regards to Tzitzis, has to be prepared in the following way. Kate said, says Rambam, you soak it, and then you bring the chilozom. So that when it came to description of the color of tcheles, the Rambam introduced by referring to tcheles ha'amura b'torah b'chol makom. Throughout Torah, it's the same color. But when it came to the specific process of where to get that color from, the Rambam specified that this is true for the tcheles of tzitzis. The implication is, you only need the chilozom for tzitzis. And set against that background, when the Rambam later on in Klei HaMikdash only talks about the color and not about the chilazon, it sounds a lot like you don't need the chilazon later on. Why would that be? That's another question, but that seems to be the opinion of the Rambam. And this is concurred with by the Aruch HaShulchan, who, in addition to writing the Aruch HaShulchan on Ul Arba Chelke Shulchan Aruch, he proceeded, just because he had more time, to write the Aruch HaShulchan HaOsid, which is a Shulchan Aruch for all of the halachas that are not relevant nowadays. Everything that the Shulchan Aruch himself missed out, but the Rambam spoke about, the Aruch HaShulchan covers all of them. Six volumes, Aruch HaShulchan HaOsid. It's truly mind-boggling how he was able to write so much. One reaches the point when one can no longer fathom how he had time to read the Aruch HaShulchan, let alone write it. And here he is writing the Aruch HaShulchan Asid. In Perek Kaf Ches, Si'if Yud, the Aruch HaShulchan states, it seems that the Rambam requires the Chilazon as the source for the Tcheles, for Tzitzit specifically, but not for Bigdei Kehuna. And we should note that this is not only a matter of hypothetical speculation. This issue came very close to being halacha, almost lamaisa. How so? As we know, in the late 1800s, a rabbi by the name of Zvi Hirsch Kalischer was pushing very hard to bring back and reinstate the offering of korbanos. It was based on an understanding that korbanos were part of what would prepare the world for the times of Mashiach. That was his hashkafa, and therefore he wrote to all of the gedolim of his time. This is Drishas Tzion, and opened up the discussion as to whether or not korbanos could be brought. And there was responses and reactions from all corners. All of the gedolim reacted to this, and there was a great deal of opposition, of course. And there were many, many areas of opposition, many, many hurdles that needed to be overcome. And specifically, the issue of Tcheles came up. How so? Well, in order for a korban to be kosher, it has to be offered by a kohen. And let's assume we know who is a kohen. Okay. But the kohen needs to wear kosher Big Day Kahuna. If he's not wearing acceptable Big Day Kahuna, the whole thing doesn't start. And therefore, if we're looking to get onto Har HaBayis, back in the day when that was considered possible, and offer a korban, if there is a chance that the Big Day Kahuna are possible, so the unfortunate Kohen who is sent to offer the korban is in a great deal of trouble. He's entered the Har HaBayis for no good reason. And moreover, he has instantly violated the Avera of Shatnas, because the belt, the avnet of the Kohen, it has wool and linen. Now, it's acceptable as long as it's kosher, but to be kosher, the wool needs to be treles. So if he gets it wrong, he loses instantly. Far from having a mitzvah, he has an Avera immediately. Now, therefore, Rabbi Kiva Eger writes to Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer and says, it seems that we could be held up here on the Tcheles issue. Because if he doesn't have Tcheles, the Avoda is possible, and we don't have Tcheles because we don't have the Chilazon. Interestingly, around about this time, the Radziner Rebbe, Rabbi Gershon Henoch Lehner, the Bala Tcheles, he was scouring the world looking for the Tcheles. It's popular because he brought it back into tzitzis, but it also potentially had implications for the Big Day Kahuna. It actually worked. It was a very opportune find, if it was right, which today it's not considered to have been exactly the Chilazon. However, Rav Kalischer responds, and I think it's fair to say and pertinent to point out, Rav Kalischer had a response to everything. And I think the reason why is because it was clear to him that korbanos had to be brought. If korbanos had to be brought, if that's the vision, then there has to be an answer. Now you just need to find it. But part of his response to this question, when Rabbi Akiva Eger said, well, we don't have the chilazon, Rav Kalischer says, if you look in the Rambam, you'll see that you only need the chilazon for your tcheles and the tzitzis. But the chilazon for the Big Day Kahuna is not required. You just need tcheles. If you can just work out what color it is, we can get that color by another means. And that was his famous response to Rabbi Akiva Eger on this question. He then became swamped by other questions, but that's how this issue came out. Now, there's just one question. Rambam seems to be saying that when it comes to the Mishkan and Big Day Kahuna, one doesn't need the Chilazon. And yet we know they trapped the Chilazon for the Mishkan. The Gemara tells us, Rava tells us, they made nets, they trapped the Chilazon. No one seems to be disputing the fact that they did it. How would the Rambam explain? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. The answer for the Rambam presumably is, the Rambam is telling you halachically what you need. You don't need the Tchelet. One could argue that the Chilazon, pardon me, you don't need the Chilazon. One could argue that the Chilazon is the optimum Tchelet. It's the ultimate Tchelet. It's the Mahadran Tchelet. But you only really need it for Tzitzis. You don't need it for the Mishkan. But nonetheless, as they were assembling their Tchelet for the Mishkan, they opted to get the Tchelet in the best possible way. There's nothing wrong with getting the Chilazon. So they trapped the Chilazon to get the Tchelet, even though they didn't need to. That presumably is the response of the Rambam. But this brings us now to a very interesting question. For this may be the key to understanding this dispute as to where we learn the Malacha of Kosher from. You see, we have a matter of principle. We derive the Malachas of Shabbos from the Malachas of the Mishkan. Whatever was done in the Mishkan represents a Malacha one can't do on Shabbos. The question is, what about a malacha that was done in the Mishkan, even though it didn't need to be done in the Mishkan? That's an interesting question. What if there was a malacha that they did as a hidur? Does that also serve as a basis for malachas of Shabbos? Tachlis, it was done, but it didn't need to be done. But it was. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, it would appear that this is at the root of the machlokas between Abaya and Rava as to where we are to derive the malacha of kosher from. Abaya says, if something snapped, you had to retie it. There's your knot. There's your kosher. Rava says, I have a better source. I mean, that's a contingency. Something had to go wrong for that to happen. But they made nets for the chilazon. That's lechatchila. Why would Abaya dispute that? Says Rabbi Yaakov, it seems that Abaya's position is that you can't learn from the nets that they used to trap the chilazon because they didn't need the chilazon for the tcheles. According to the Rambam, they could have used something else. And therefore this now becomes, it's a very delicate machlokas now, a malacha that was done in the best possible way but didn't need to be done at all. Is that the preferred source, or maybe something that needed to be done even though something had to go wrong in order for it to be needed to be done? This is the classic analysis of Rabbi Yaakov with regards to this machlokas, where we get the malacha of kosher from. Okay, and of course a great deal of discussions are spawned from that, and some of them continue until our time. Now the parsha discusses the manufacture of the Mishkan, and in the beginning of Perek Lamed Zayin, it describes the making of the Aron. Perek Lamed Zayin Pasuk Aleph. Vayas Betzala Les Ha'oron Atzei Shittim. Betzala made the Oron. Okay. Important to note, by the way, that this should not be confused. This is the first time the Torah has referred to Betzalel as making the Oron. There is an earlier Pasuk in the beginning of Perek Lamed Vav, actually, if we take a look. Perek Lamed Vav Pasuk Aleph, which states, V'asav v'tzalel v'ahaliyav v'chol ish chachamlev asher nasan Hashem chochma v'sfuna behema l'das l'asos es kol avodas hakodesh l'chol asher tziva Hashem. So the Pasuk seems to already describe Bezalel doing things, making things. But it's very important to know how to translate the word v'asav. The word v'asav could actually be translated in two ways, and they go in two different directions. For as we know, the word asa is past tense. The vav at the beginning of the word ve'asa could do one of two things. It could either simply mean and, that is to say, the word asa remains in the past tense and the vav means and he made. But it's also possible that the vav is not the vav conjunctive to mean and, but it's the vav conversive, it's the vav ahipuch. It actually changes the past into the future, like v'omarta zevach pesachu, changes omarta to v'omarta, the past to the future. And the difference is that if v'asa is the past tense and the vav merely means and, then this is already describing Bezalel making things. If v'asa is the vav ahipuch, it is yet Hashem describing to Moshe what Bezalel will do. It is yet in the tzivui stage. How can we know? Well, says Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin, Very simply. Have a look at the next pasuk. Pasuk Beis, Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Beis, Vayikra Moshe El Betzala Ve'El Ahliyah Ve'El Kolish Chacham Lev, Asher Nasan Hashem Chochma Belibo. Moshe calls them all together in Pasuk Gimel, Vayikru Lifnei Moshe Es Kol HaTruma Asher Heviu B'nei Yisrael Lemleches Avodas HaKodesh. They took all the materials. That means no one's done anything until Pasuk Beis. So Pasuk Aleph, the Pasuk before, can't be describing them making anything. They haven't taken the materials yet. The word va'asar clearly must be yet in the future, and the vav is vavahipuch. The reason why it's important to state this is because a mistake was made as the chapters were divided, chapter and verse were divided, because this pasuk, va'asar, is the beginning of a perek. The beginning of a perek is a new thing, and va'asar sounds like it's a description of something that happened. It says, v'bishur leib diskin, whoever divided the Chumash into Prokim did not understand what this Pasuk was doing. And by the way, we know, parenthetically, it was not done by Talmid HaChachamim, it wasn't even done by Jews. It was done by some helpful Gentile, first and foremost, to help other Gentiles quote chapter and verse against Judaism. Subsequently, it's been accepted by all. No one objects to it on religious grounds, even though it had very ignoble origins. But that doesn't guarantee that he understood how to learn the psukim. So he saw the word va'asa, and it's the beginning of a new inyan. It's not the beginning. This is yet the end. It continues from the psukim from pasuk lamed, perek lamed hey pasuk aleph. Ru'u kara Hashem b'shem Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur l'matei Yehuda. Hashem has chosen Bezalel to do the following, and the final pasuk of that section is what we know as the first pasuk of Perek Lamed Vav. It's not the beginning of a perek, it's the end of a perek. It's yet describing what Bezalel will do. So that's important just to know for the correct understanding of the psukim. But to get back to the beginning of Perek Lamed Zayin, so the pasuk describes Bezalel making the Aron. And Rashi has a famous comment. For we will note that, or Rashi's words firstly are, on the words Vayas Bezalel, Lefisha Nosan Nafsho al Hamalocha. Since he put himself out and dedicated himself to the Malocha, Yosem Mishar Chachamim, more than any of the other wise men there, Nikres al Shemo, the making of the Aron is called after his name. What Rashi is responding to is the fact that the word Vayas has appeared a number of times and will appear a number of times. Only in the pronoun. He made. We assume it's Bezalel. And we're not aware of anyone else who would be the one. But for all the Vayas is, the only time that his name is mentioned is here in the beginning of Perek Lamed Zayin. So that, of course, now is a question. If every Vayas is Bezalel, so then who is Bezalel when it says Vayas Bezalel? Therefore, Rashi says something else has happened. The Pasuk isn't informing us who made it, that's always true, but the Pasuk is making a point of attaching Bezalel's name to the Aron in recognition of the fact that he put himself out for it more than the other Chachamim. Okay. It's interesting to note, one could perhaps have offered a simpler solution to the problem. After all, we know that Bezalel wasn't the only one who was involved in the Mishkan. He had with him Ahliyav. Under them they had Chachmei Lev. That's a team of people. And therefore, even as it says Vayas, it doesn't mean that Bezalel was the only one involved. It means he was overseeing everything, but there could have been more involved. If that's the case, then perhaps one could have suggested that the difference between Vayas generally as opposed to Vayas Bezalel specifically is that if it says Vayas, it's Bezalel overseeing, but it could be others were involved, whereas Vayas Bezalel implies exclusively Bezalel was involved. That would seem to be a very sound resolution. The reason why Rashi doesn't offer that resolution is because it is very difficult to say that Bezalel was the only one involved in the making of the Aron. For interestingly, the Aron is the only kli in the Mishkan which the Torah commands to make in the plural. Ve'asu Aron, atzei shitim. All of the other kelim are in the singular. Ve'asisa menorah, ve'asisa shulchan. The Aron is ve'asu. The Torah insisted there be more than one person involved in making the Aron. So when it says Vayas Bezalel as Aron, it can't mean to say that Bezalel alone was involved. Rather, says Rashi, it means others may have been involved, but it will always be known after Betzalel, Lefisha, Nosan, Libo, Alamelach. Nosan, Nafsho, Alamelach. So, that's Rashi's comment on Vayas Betzalel. Meshechachma has two further comments. As we know, when it comes to the manufacture of the kelim for the Mishkan, we discussed this 1 or 2 weeks ago, intention is key. Purity of intent is key. V'asu li mikdash, li lishmi, it has to be done for the right reasons. Says Meshechachma, if the Mishkan generally needs to be manufactured for the right reasons, for pure motivation, with pure thoughts, then there is no item in the Mishkan that would more require purity of thought than the Aron. The entire Mishkan is Kodesh. The Aron is Kodesh Kadoshim. And therefore, if it is a sensitive issue, it is a hypersensitive issue when it comes to the Aron. That's where the Shechina resides. And therefore, Betzalel, who is referred to by the Torah, he is the one who has Bechachma, Betvuna, Uvedas. So in a sense, his name is mentioned explicitly and specifically with reference to the Aron, as if to say when it came to the Aron, nothing was left to chance. Betzalel was vigilant and oversaw it in a way that exceeded his involvement in other areas of the Mishkan. And there is a further point. Not only is the Aron a sensitive vessel because it's where the Shekhinah is, it's sensitive because it has appurtenances that if they're misunderstood would result in a terrible situation. It has images on top of it. The Kuvim. So the Aron is covered by these two Kuvim. Now, the Jewish people have just recently, hopefully, recovered from a terrible fall in this area of the Chet HaEgel. They invested too much in a physical form. And therefore, it is crucial that no one be allowed to be involved in the manufacture of the Aron would be in any way tainted or compromised by the recent experience of the Egel. It's got to be entrusted by someone who's above suspicion. And that's Betzalel. Betzalel, as he's introduced, Ben Uri, Ben Hur. Betzalel's credentials are set. His grandfather was killed trying to oppose the Egel. Betzalel has no sympathy for the Egel or what it represented. And therefore, says Meshechachma, that's why the Pasuk says when it comes to the Aron, if Betzalel generally needed to be involved with all of the Kli HaMishkan, he much more specifically needs to be involved in the Aron for the reasons that we mentioned. It's the Kodesh HaKodoshim, it has the Kruvim. Betzalel is mentioned explicitly. And it's very interesting because here we see the words of the Pasuk. When the Pasuk says something that we knew already, because Vayas always meant Betzalel, but it stresses Betzalel, it means to indicate that he's involved to a higher level. It's a very interesting way of the Torah communicating a message. Betzalel is not a different person when he's mentioned by name, but his level of involvement is communicated on a higher level. And secondly, says Meshechachma, and this is very interesting, we know that the Aron contained the Luchos. That's the Aron Ha'edus. But as we've discussed on previous occasions, it's not enough to say that the Aron contained the Luchos. It's more correct to say that the Aron existed for the Luchos. That is to say, the entire reason that the Aron is there is to house the Luchos. It's rather different than saying that there is a mitzvah to put the Luchos in the Aron. And this is pointed out by the Rashash in his notes to Maseches Yuma and Daf Nun Gimel. Interestingly, if we go back to last week's Parsha, it's almost explicit now. The Aron is always referred to as Aron Ha'edus, so the Aron of the testimony referring to the Luchos. But in last week's Parsha, in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Zayin, where the items of the Mishkan are listed off again. So it refers to the Aron. And the phraseology is very telling for us. It states, Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Zayin, Es Ohel Moed, Ve'es Ha'aron, Lo Eidus. Elsewhere, before and after, the Aron has been referred to as Aron Ha'Eidus. Here it's referred to as Ha'aron Lo Eidus. Says Rashash, the connotation of the letter Lamed tells us more explicitly that the Aron is there for the Eidus. That's what it's for. Why is there an Aron? Lo Eidus. And the relationship of the Aron to the Eidus, they become bound up intimately now. There's a fascinating comment, just to see how far this goes, of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky in Shmuel, and of course Rabbi Yaakov, for him all of Tanakh is one. Later on, in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, when in the times of Eli, it's just the beginning of the story of Shmuel, they go to war with the Plishtim, they take the Aron out, and the Aron is captured, and it stays with the Plishtim for a good few months. And as the news comes back to Eli and to those back home that the Aron was taken, so the words of the Pasuk are, Va'aron ha'elokim nilkocha. The Aron was taken. Now, nilkocha is a feminine form. Aron is masculine. Pasuk should have said, Va'aron ha'alokim nilkach. How can we understand that the Aron can be referred to with a feminine noun, with a feminine verb, nilkacha? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and it's a fascinating area of Torah, sometimes we find that the Pasuk injects into a word, into the base of a word, aspects of other words in order to express a certain element of the character of the word. Milim Murkavot, composite words, they're called. And there are a number of examples. It really shows how the Torah uses words. It's not so strict to say if it's a masculine noun or get a masculine verb. No, because the more we understand, and this is an expression of the fact that the Aron so much exists only for the Eidus, if Eidus is a feminine noun, the Aron itself can be referred to in the feminine. Because the Aron is practically the shell around the Eidus. And grammatically, it can be referred to accordingly. Ad kedei kach. Indeed, says the Rashash, it's for this very reason that we find that after the first Aron was hidden in the days of Yoshiyahu, so in the second Beis HaMikdash, they remanufactured everything. It was all new. But they didn't make an Aron. As we know from the Mishnah in Yuma, those in Daf Yomi have just recently gone through it, there was nothing in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Eben Shasiya, the sprinkling of the blood of the Kohen Gadol, was where the Aron used to be. Says the Rashash, well, why not make a new Aron? You made a new everything else, a new Shulchan, a new Menorah, a new Mizbeach. Says the Rashash, there's no point in making a new Aron. The only time you'd ever need to make new Aron is if you've got new Luchos, because the Aron only exists to hold the Luchos. So the Aron with the Luchos was hidden, and so until further notice, there's no meaning to have another Aron. That's really the practical fallout from the way the Torah is describing that. If the Aron is La Eidus, so if you don't know where the Eidus are, so there's no point in making a new Aron. Says the Meshech Chochma, such a fascinating comment. This, of course, it's the Torah talking, it's in the future, but this is alluded to in our Pasuk. For with regards to all of the other kelim of the Mishkan, the Pasuk says, Vayas, he made it. Well, we know who made it. We know who he is. He's Betzalah. But the Pasuk doesn't say Betzalah. But it does with the Aron. Now, why would the Pasuk tell me that Betzalah made the Aron? I know that Vayas always refers to Betzalah. Here says Meshech Chochmah, the Torah is alluding to the fact that Betzalah was the only one who made the Aron. There would never be another Aron. Because if you have Betzalah's Aron, you've got the Luchos. And if you don't, there's no point in making another one. And therefore, the Torah mentioning Betzalah's name by the Aron, the Aron is exclusively a Betzalah creation. As indeed was borne out through history. We either had the Aron of Betzalah or nothing else. Everything else, Vayas, could refer as surely to the one who made it later on as it did to the one who made it originally. So these are fascinating comments, again responding to Rashi's issue of why Betzalah's name was mentioned with regards to the Mishkan. So let's conclude by referring to one of the contributions to the Mishkan, famous contributions that were made by the Nesi'im. And that is referred to in Pasuk Kaf Zayin, of Perek Lamed Hei. Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Kaf Zayin, V'hanesiyim hei viyu, the Nesiyim brought, Esavnei Shoam, Esavnei Miluim, V'eifod, V'lachoshin. Okay. So they brought those precious stones. We will note that the word Nesiyim is written chaser. It's written without a yud at the end. Okay, and Rashi will comment on that, and we'll take a look at that shortly. But so far, we're just looking at the word itself. Hanasiyim, chaser. What are we to make of that? Well, the Netziv in the Hamikdavar says something very interesting. Al derech hapshat. This is the first time we really have mention of the Nesi'im. Their contributions, their donations to the Mishkan. Very nice. But it's interesting to consider that if someone asked us at what point did the Nesi'im become the Nesi'im, we probably would have said when the Mishkan was set up. Because that's the first time we see them acting in an official capacity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu recalls them. Nasi Echad Layom, Nasi Echad Layom. That's the first time Hashem talks about Nesi'im. So who made the Nesi'im in this early stage? I mean, this is weeks and months before the Chanukah Samishkan. How are they already Nesi'im? It seems, says the Netziv, that the people related to them as Nesi'im. In other words, the concept existed. There was a personality within each Shevet. He was the Nasi of that Shevet. It wasn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't make him into the Nasi. We have no knowledge of that, but it was a natural appointment. It's a great irony, because these were actually the individuals that HaKadosh Baruch Hu subsequently ratified as the Nesi'im. So what Korach accused Moshe of doing for Aaron, which wasn't true, it was actually yes true of a lot of people in his corner. Because the Nesi'im were actually with him on that occasion, according to Rashi. So therefore we have an interesting situation. They're Nesi'im without portfolio. They haven't yet been appointed divinely as Nesi'im, but they are recognized as such by the people. Says the Netziv, that's why the word Nesi'im is written chaser. Because they're unofficially Nesi'im. We would say they're not Nesi'im with a capital N. The Torah says they're not Nesi'im with a Yud. There is something chaser, because no one's actually said that they are Nesi'im. They're just related to as such. It's interesting to note in this respect that the Netziv is preceded by the Ibn Ezra. For the Ibn Ezra notes that, what did they bring? They brought these precious stones. It sounds like they were the only ones who had precious stones. Why? Says Ibn Ezra, well, as we know, before the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, they borrowed things from their neighbors. Well, what did they borrow? It probably depends who your neighbors were. So if you were the everyman, and you borrowed from the Egyptian everyman, you might, if you were lucky, you'd get some gold and silver. But these were Nesi'im. Now, they were oppressed Nesi'im, but they had a higher level of antagonist. And therefore, the doors that they knocked on were the Egyptian Nesi'im. And when everyone else got gold and silver, they got diamonds. And that's how they were able. So it's interesting that for the Ibn Ezra, already in Mitzrayim, they have this unofficial status, which is recognized almost as by the Mitzrayim themselves. Rashi comments in a rather more critical way. So it's from the Medrash that they shouldn't have waited. There's something negative about this. They said that we'll let the Jewish people offer whatever they need to offer. And Masha Chaser Anachdu Nashlim. Whatever is left at the end, so we'll take care of it. Well, in the end, it was almost finished. They had to rush to be able to give anything because the Jewish people came forward with such an abundance. And that was considered incorrect. And therefore, the yud is missing. There's something chaser from this donation. It says in the name of Rav Shneur Kotler Zatzal that what's at stake here is not merely quote-unquote laziness, atzlus what's called, but a misunderstanding of what donating to the Mishkan is all about. The notion is that one gives what needs to be, it's to fill a need. But really we've been told from the beginning of Truma, v'yikhuli Truma, the giving is really for the benefit of the Jewish people. The giving is the process becomes the goal. And therefore, if it's the goal, then one doesn't wait to see what's left, because that's very functional, that's utilitarian. But one should rush to be part of the process. That was really the mistake of the Nasiim. But to conclude on a positive note, they were last in donations. They were first in inaugurations. They volunteered to bring korbanos, and it's wonderful, really, to observe that they lost one letter in Parshas Vayakhel, but they got a few dozen psukim in Parshas Noso. That is to say, what the Torah criticizes by the fact that they shouldn't have waited till the end, it repays them back a hundredfold and more. Parshas Noso is twice its natural size because of the Chanukas Hanasiim, and therefore the lesson was learned, and that gets the full endorsement, encouragement of the Torah, and of course the lesson for us as well, for all of the causes that there are available, to wait to see what the cause needs. Perhaps we're missing a sense of what the cause is all about. One of the many lessons from the Mishkan. We'll leave it over there for this week.